Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys were rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Bro.
Look like gangbangers, working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take it.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to One Heat Minute. The 1995 crime opus Heat is a movie that we've been unpacking chronologically from minute one to now, minute 166. My guest today is the only guest on the entire series whose name appears in the minute that they're here to talk about. It is with great pleasure and honor, it's just absolutely insane that this is happening. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the amazing auteur behind this incredible opus, Michael Mann. Michael Mann, welcome to One Heat Minute.
Great, thanks very much. I'm very flattered that you're doing this.
Well, I'm very happy that you actually heard about its existence while we were doing it.
I did. I heard about it in New York about five months ago, and it sounded completely insane in a totally wonderful way. So,
well, thank you so much for that. That's the highest possible compliment that I can get from you. Completely insane. I do have to thank Bilge Ibiri, who I believe brought it to your attention at that time. So, thank you so much. Look, the normal format of the show would be for us to, you know, watch a minute, whether that's remotely, watch the final minute of the movie, and the listeners will listen along to the audio grab of that minute. But I think I'm going to forgo that because there's only one person in the world who maybe has watched this movie more than me, and that's you. So I don't think we need to watch the minute. I might pause ever so briefly so the people at home who are listening to this can listen along, but then we can come back and talk about the final moment of your 1995 epic Heat together.
Terrific. Good.
So, Michael, this final swelling, soaring moment underscored by Moby's God moving over the face of waters, I believe east of Aviation in LAX is exactly where it took place. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, you talked about retrofitting this entire narrative really around this moment. And so, you know, taking this the grand scale and sort of making it beautifully intimate and graceful in these final moments. Can you talk about like what unlocked the rest of the narrative for you for this particular moment, this interaction, this engagement?
Yeah, it's kind of the difference between contradiction and counterpoint. What occurred to me, I don't recall the exact sequence that occurred to me, but it's kind of reverse engineered in this sense that Neil McCauley is fortunate enough to be passing out of existence in the short time we all have, with nothing on the other side of it, but passing out of existence with the only other person in the universe of this film with whom he has a very deep rapport, and they're unique in the two of them, Hannah and Vincent, in that both of them are totally conscious. They're both completely self-aware. There's no games. There's no self-deception. There's no just kind of drifting through life with a number of ambitions that go fulfilled, a whole bunch go unfulfilled, and then by the time you wake up to the fact that they're unfulfilled, it's too late because you're too old, and then that's too bad. And there's none of that blindness. They have almost no filters as each man takes in, his existence in the present moment, as well as what's before him, what's made him the way he is. And for both of these guys, the real important thing is that who they were determines how they are now, and how they are now is determining what's going to happen to them. So McCauley is fortunate enough to die with, in a very close contact with the guy with whom he has the most rapport in the artificial limited universe of the motion picture. At the one and the same time, this is the man who killed him.
Yes.
And leading and that confrontation, that combat between the two of these men is something that we had two different states of mind about, and that's totally intentional and constructed, and why I say it's contrapuntal in this sense that we're mostly invested in Hannah. When we're in the Hannah story, we're not 50% with Hannah, we're 100% with Hannah. We want to know what's going to happen. We want Hannah to intercept McCauley. We want that to happen. At the same time, when we're with McCauley, we want him to escape with Edie. We don't want him to stop for Wayne Grove. There's very good reasons why he stopped for Wayne Grove, but just taking it kind of in reverse, we want him to escape, and we want that 100 to happen. And our investment in it is emotionally, psychologically, philosophically is also at 100%. So then the question became, why do that, and can you bring audiences into those not contradictory, but contrapuntal states of mind? Because if one can, then you have something that kind of lives in a way that sustains in memory, as opposed to stories that totally end and then they're resolved and then they're forgotten, or maybe a small piece of poignance is missing. And I was moved by Vivaldi, moved by Bach. So it's not accidental that I was interested in constructing it. But from that, from kind of the genome of this end conflict, working backwards, it had to be the culmination of who each man is that's driven him to this moment. Hannah does not deceive himself. He's ruined these marriages. He's obsessed with one thing: all I am is who I'm going after.
Yes.
He says to Justine. And that's totally true. McCauley elected to live by an inflexible kind of catechism that he's found what he's after, which is not here in the United States. It's something in Fiji, something he found in the magazine. It doesn't really matter what it is, but it's an ideation of
an ideation of an island fantasy.
And so he is with a brutal you know, kind of discipline, he reduces himself. He wants to reduce risk, and that has to do with being anonymous and not having connections. So he's correctly analyzed the circumstances of his life, the objective, the human condition he has to have to achieve this, which is a calculation about risk, reduce risk. Who was that bank robber? I don't know. He was kind of middle-aged. What did he look like? Well, he was kind of a gray suit, white shirt, gray hair. That's all I can tell you. That's everybody or anybody and nobody, and have no attachments. He's reached his own rules that he set for himself with Edie, and because he did that, Helen had this passion that was supposed to happen later is suddenly happening now in the foreground of the temporal track of his life. And suddenly going anywhere, some island in Fiji, doesn't mean anything if she's not going to go with him.
Yes.
And he almost, you know, opens his chest, and he has to get out what he's thinking, and he does. And then she agrees to go with him. So all of a sudden, the co-ordered set of laws and rules and physics of his life has been cast aside, and he's being spontaneous, and it's working.
Yes.
So suddenly, spontaneity and emotionality and intuition and instinct is taken over, and it's succeeding, and it's bringing in his foreground what he desires. Consequently, as he's leaving, he no longer has navigation.
Yes.
He's a ship without a rudder, and that's why he's vulnerable to the allure of going after Wengrove, which is bait that Hannah set up. Knows that Neil is smart to go for it because Hannah doesn't know about Edie except for what he was told in the coffee shop scene. So Hannah's given up that this is going to even happen, but that allure of vengeance on Wengrove for all the damage he causes takes Neil, who's now emotionalized, and that's why he deviates. And that then when Hannah sees a woman alone in a car in a state of anxiety, and Neil had told him about a woman. He just intuits that this is where he is. That's what drives us to the ending.
Yeah, I was just going to say, when I originally conceived of this idea and was working through it, I didn't realize what would be the most sought-after minute for people to want to come and talk to us about and unpack on this show. And obviously, you know, it could be the opening, the brilliance of the opening heist, some of Vincent's wonderful and quotable interrogation scenes. Obviously, the centerpiece of the film being the coffee house conversation at Kate Manolini's. But I was struck by the minutes that you just mentioned, that Neil surrendering to instinct as opposed to his program, and then him wrestling with what is program, what is instinct, what is emotion in the tunnel scene. The tunnel scene was one of the most sought after scenes to speak about on the entire show for, I think, a lot of the reasons that you just sort of summed up in what we were talking about.
Yeah, and I think audiences are quite brilliant, and in a way, we all are much more than we know. We're very, very smart baboons in the sense that we have a lot of animal instinct that we're not aware of, but we perceive way more than we can clock cognitively. And so the history of how Neo got to that moment in the tunnel when the light gets bright, I think people carry a lot of that with them. They couldn't necessarily analyze it in language, but I think they understand it. And they understand that he's with her. And it's not just keep going, get away. It's a lot more than that. It's we understand the pull and why he's vulnerable to the pull of, you know, as he is in that moment.
In that moment, I was lucky enough to speak to a film critic and editor of RogerEbert.com, Matt Zoller-Zeitz, and he said of Robert De Niro, one of your stars, that there is maybe nothing more powerful in American cinema than putting a camera in front of Robert De Niro's face and just watching him think. Can you talk a little bit about working with, you know, the man, the Neil McCauley, the Neil McCauley of this piece, and working with him and helping him sort of, I believe you said before, to paraphrase, seek the character, sort of get inside himself and then seek and explore beyond that character. Can you talk a little bit about that for us?
Sure. And by the way, that moment we shot it one night, and after we shot it, Bob and I both know we didn't get it, and then we went back and shot it a second night, and you know it still wasn't there, and it was on the third night that we went back, and it's you know, and we knew what we were after, and on the third night, you know, I got it, and I just, you know, the moment I got it, it's there, and it's all, and it requires exactly what you said. It requires him thinking, and but it's what you're thinking about, you know. And before we shot the scene with Edie on that ridge over the Pacific in the Palisades, where he opens his heart, he forces himself to he impels himself to reach inside himself, pull out his heart, and say, "Here's nothing means anything anymore if I'm not with you, you know, if you're not with me." You know, we were lighting, and then I, you know, and Bob asked if I'd come into his motorhome when I did, and he said, "Tell me what am I?" He knew what he was thinking, but he said, you know, this is about 5 minutes. What am I thinking? Why am I, you know, how desperate is this? You know, and we talked about it some more. And then I went away. The lighting continued. Back the motor over. And then we had another conversation about it, you know, because he was so determined to bring himself to that rot moment of you go to, you know, you are going to explode if you can't get this out.
Yes.
It's not just that this life's not worth living if you're not with me. It's but a guy who thought, you know, he's a double zero with the needle moving the other way. All, you know, for him, this is not normal. Oh, I met a girl on a date and I really like her. This is a whole different thing. I mean, the real world contrast between the self abnegation and the vacuity of imposed, the kind of monkish existence that he imposed on himself, and what that heat of being with this woman, and what that means, that attraction. It's limbic systems. It's, you know, intellect. It's love. It's testosterone. It's everything together, and he has to, you know. So he was obsessive about finding exactly what should be in his mind. And then the words take care of themselves when you're an actor, when you're a great actor like De Niro.
Yes.
What I mean by that is that De Niro knows that the words will take care of himself. Al knows the words will take care of themselves. You know, you learn it stone cold and you forget it because it's just going to come. It's what's going on inside of you that requires that build.
And especially for Robert, as you said, the alchemy of his inner turmoil is completely off kilter in that scene. You've seen him firing almost with the, you know, with the precision of an engine. You know, all those things, like you said, instinct. You know, his testosterone, like muting. You know, like his monkish existence mutes love. And in that scene, it's just, you know, let's get all the ingredients to this experiment, this explosive experiment. Let's just shake it up. And he is literally bursting in that moment. And I think that's what, you know, speaking of a terrific, you know, wordless performance, Amy Brenneman's performance in sort of that blurred foreground is something to behold as well, in reaction, in contrast,
right,
to this, you know, to his turmoil behind her.
No, absolutely. I mean, she she's somebody. LA is a really easy place to not find your way.
Yes.
And It always has been a kind of a virtual city. Again, London, in a funny way, is similar. There's pockets of culture. It's not like New York. It's not like I move from this neighborhood to that neighborhood and there's an entire subculture that I know I'm going to live within.
Yes.
L.A. is alienated in a landscape and geography too. Not so much anymore because too many people from New York moving here. So consequently, the whole city has now become completely overpopulated. It's almost like these little tendrils of light, which is like cars on a freeway at night, that are the arteries that connect one mode of existence to another mode of existence. And she's selling books. I mean, she's and doesn't probably esteem herself very highly.
Yes.
And she's quite modest. What has romance, what has sexuality been for Neil Macaulay before he meets her? And it's been strictly transactional.
Yes.
Physical, kind of impersonal. And there's a great prison poem that was written. I forgot who wrote it, but it's the man's too sure, the woman's too easy, the pace is too fast, the love is too short. That's been his experience. And then to meet Edie, it's, you know, obviously it's night and day.
Yeah, she's loving, tender, open, and warm. You know, that amazing balcony scene with the, you know, the flood of lights of L.A. And she says, you get lonely. And he says, I'm alone, I'm not lonely, you. And the power of her response going, yeah, I get lonely. Just the candor, the openness. It's like, it's an authenticity he probably hasn't ever experienced. If we're talking about that prison poetic consequence, you know, this woman's too easy, they're too transactional. But she's sincerity incarnate. You know, she can't help but be that. And that's great about Amy's performance. It's just that it just lives in
real life. She's a conscious aware person. She has a past, she has a present. She has feelings, she has emotions, she has character. And what she's unaware of is that he's a stick of dynamite.
Yes.
He is state raised. He is dissociative, somewhat sociopathic, selectively sociopathic. It really truly is, if it rains, you get wet, about everybody else who can get in the way of between his crew and his crew's objectives. Doesn't matter who they are. I mean, and he's denied himself any really intense human, you know, a normal human reaction. So he may look like a normal guy. That's the last thing he is. And that's, you know, that's where the real kind of intensity. So he's not like anybody she ever met.
No. And that the kitchen scene, you know, one of the coldest lines I think he says in the movie, you know, and he's pretty cold, as you said, selectively sociopathic at times. I tell you what I don't do. I don't sell medals. It's just it's a beautiful turn of phrase as the writer of this film, but it's a line that haunts me when I watch their relationship unfold in this movie. I tell you what I don't do. I don't sell medals. So let's talk about the location, LAX. This, and you said it was kind of this, you talked about it being LAX being a transient space. And I was really lucky, one of the preceding episodes that's going to be released just before we have a chat is Reed Coleman, your co-author of the upcoming prequel novel, talked about you sort of enlightening him to spaces, particularly spaces that sort of function as both being inside and outside spaces. So was that important for you in the construction of this scene in this LA where it's like a transient space, this inside and outside space? Was that something you were thinking about consciously for constructing this final combat, this final showdown?
Yeah, it's critical. It's as much to me as we take in everything. I mean, as audience, as human beings, we just take in everything.
Yes.
And so everything has meaning, which means if you're a director or I believe in the work that I do anyway, that everything should talk, sometimes very quietly, but everything should talk. A place should talk, and a space should talk. And the interesting, there's a certain romance about airports at night. For some reason that I had all the way up through the 90s, I don't have it now, but I certainly did then. and it was about the, you know, the lights on the at the end of the runway, and I think what was attractive about it, what made it feel so transient to me, and the kind of space that could trigger a real kind of existential awareness, is because none of it is ergonomic. It's not about spaces that are designed to facilitate our bipedal bodies and how we move. It's got nothing to do with us.
Yes.
And the ends of runways, okay, or the apron on the approach of runways, and that's why I was attracted to that. Just before the runway, those red and white checkered houses, and the cast aluminum brackets for the lights, and that turn on. It's not about people. It's not places we drive, walk, sit, eat, sleep. It's completely about. It's just industrial, and it's quite beautiful. But at the same time, it has the allure is something I can't really quantify it in language. But the allure has something to do with the fact that it's just not about us, and. In its industrial kind of aesthetic, and its utility, and that was actually obviously we shot it. That really was LAX. On top of that, we've got 747s coming in.
Yes.
Every 2.5-3 minutes, and those aren't visual effects. Those are airplanes over our heads. And ground would shake, and the noise was insane. And that's really where we were, you know. It rolls together, you know. How should I put it? It's like when you know you've got the right place, and then we built a couple more of those red and white checkered houses that were actually there, and then you're shooting it. And it's the middle of the night, and these lights are going on, and these planes are roaring overhead. You think you're doing something, but you're not. You're just standing there, shot. It's like. As a director, it's kind of
yes.
This environment is the perfect place to encompass, you know, this scene, and to have it in kind of a spherical way, and to have the scene play out here. It was quite magical. It also happened to be the week that the Unabomber was threatening to blow up LAX.
Yes, that's what I've read. I was actually about to ask you about that.
Which is kind of crazy and coincidental, because the guy who was very instrumental in discovering the Unabomber and breaking that story for CBS was Lowell Bergman, who Al Pacino plays in Insider.
Absolutely.
You know, and we were, and of course you couldn't do anything like that now, but.
There has been a rumor, and I'd love to, if you could confirm it, that it was a few extra stakes for the guys in the air traffic control room to direct a few, passages of time to get you some quiet on those runways. Is that just a rumor that I've read, or is that has got a little taste of fact?
No, that's not true.
That's a fiction.
They were just friendly, and we did stop, and we were very nice to them. You know, yes. we did stop in and say hi and thank him and everything else. But no, nobody bribed them with steaks. I had to reroute. I did get traffic to reroute when we were doing Mohicans, because we couldn't have contrails in the sky.
Yes.
Today, you know, for $1,000, it doesn't matter. It's in the sky digitally. You just take it out.
Yes.
But then back in 92, that wasn't the case. And so we did get the air traffic controllers to reroute some flights that wouldn't have contrails in the sky, and, you know, able to close state highways and all that.
So let's get to... we just spoke about him, the incredible Al Pacino, who you work with on The Insider, which is also a stunning masterpiece of a film that could absolutely, in my mind, be held up to the scrutiny of a minute-by-minute podcast, but I won't be doing that. I won't be doing that. I'll leave that to another Michael Mann obsessive to carry the reins there. But can you talk about him just delivering, again, a magnificent, wordless performance where he's like... his face is like a tsunami of all of those different emotions and awareness. And
sure. I mean, Al is, you know, he's a great, great artist. He's a complete genius in how he brings character into himself. He all of his performance is, I'm going to give you an example. Al learns dialogue, Stone Cold, 2 weeks before he's going to, before you're going to shoot it.
Yes.
And the reason he does it is because he wants to dream the scene. He wants to wake up in the morning when you're half conscious, kind of thinking about it, and it's playing in his head. And so what he does is avail himself of all of the different states of consciousness that we all experience as people, as human beings. And it is such an honest process, such an honest artistic process with Al, because it permeates all of them. And so consequently, there's a couple of characteristics that of the honesty and the high artistic integrity of working with an artist like Al Pacino. One is, if you imagine somebody who does that, has the ability to do it.
Yes.
You know, almost nobody else has. He has the ability to do it. You would imagine the following. He has tremendous courage. Al, well, you know, he will hesitate not for an instant to kind of, you know, play high E on the violin, is the analogy he uses, or walk a tightrope without a net. And if a new idea on take five is a complete catastrophe, he doesn't care.
Yeah.
That was terrible. On to the next. We had a couple of, you know, so when we would do something, Al would usually nail it on take five, six, or seven.
Okay? Yes.
When we got it, you know, he'd say, let me do a wild one. I said, go ahead. You know, and what that meant was that he would throw all the programs out. We would start the scene, and Al would intentionally have no idea where this is going to go. And sometimes they were horrible. Sometimes they were brilliant, you know. And the only time we ran into a jam is when the other actor on the other side, if it was a character actor, somebody who was coming in, you know, we're now in our, you know, 80th day of principal photography. We're doing this all the time on every scene. And we, in one instance in particular, I forgot to warn the actor that, by the way, this means that we're just going to see what happens. We're just going to be completely improvisational. And I forgot to tell him. And then Al lets loose, and and it was the scene when he's throwing Hank Azaria around, who had no idea that Al was going to bend his wrist back, toss him in a chair, and then deliver that whole monologue about showing.
Well, I think Hank Azaria has talked about that, and it's so wonderful to hear, like how we've only sort of heard from his side that it was improvisational, but it's so magnificent, I guess, that you were so dialed into his process, and you guys were so comfortable in this rhythm that, you know, you always sort of threw couple of improvisationals once you knew what you had, just to throw everything out, just to try and be organic and lean into whatever the feeling of the energy of that space was giving you at that moment.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, the core of, but Al completely embraced who Hannah was.
Yes.
and because it has a real correlation to who an actor like Al is in life, which is that he was obsessive. Hannah's obsessive about, driven to as a detective to figure out, and then to apprehend, to hunt, big game. And in that, as a detective, he's no different than a heavyweight fighter who doesn't have anticipatory anxiety about getting in a ring. He can't wait to get into the ring.
Yes.
Or an actor who can't wait to get on stage. And the more challenging, the higher the mountain, the more difficult it is, the more alluring it is, the more you go after it.
Yes.
And so that line in which he says, all I am is who I'm going after, he knows what he's done. I mean, it dominates his life. And it's not that act, that that drive is not about to serve and protect. If you had Hannah, and for that matter, you could have Al too, and you said, you know, tell me what is the most powerful motivator of all the motivations any human being has, and all the motivations you have for doing this work, this quest that you're on. You know, you're only allowed to tell me one. What's the most powerful one? It's all I am is who I'm going after. It's hunting.
Yes.
And of course he has a moral compass. More than, you know, Neil McCauley does it. Hannah has a moral compass. There is right and wrong. Not only that, like an actor, he intakes his emotional reaction to heinous crimes, and he uses that, like an actor will use sometimes very ugly things to make himself sharper, to make himself more intuitive,
yes,
to make himself be able to guess or see something that defies analysis, that's not about language, it's just an instinct. And it's like you suddenly find yourself in one moment in time hunting Neil McCauley, you find yourself in the compulsory casino, the casino where you have to bet.
Yes.
And you have to bet in the next 5 seconds or 10 seconds. And that's when that intuition will click in. So the guy who tracked Neil McCauley down when he realized that Neil McCauley had made the people who were tailing them, and probably just like a detective, that Neil McCauley probably has his employment records, is going to make on Hannah, and he has this intuitive brilliance off the moment with Justine when he's bereft.
Yes.
That motivates him to go do something. Neil McCauley goes and he stops him, and he has that coffee conversation. It's like, where do these ideas come from in our lives? Where does this brilliant insight come from when you suddenly you don't deduce through pattern recognition? It suddenly occurs to you, and it's not magical. It's causative, but it comes from, you know, what Buddhists call karma in a funny kind of a way, because if you had a microscope that could examine down to fine microscopic levels, causality. This has caused that. That's caused the other thing in our lives. There's no magic. There's no spirit. But there truly is causality, and that makes these moments happen. And then he knows when he's there in the coffee shop. He knows why he's in the coffee shop. And Hannah knows. And Neil McCauley knows why he's in the coffee shop. They're both doing the same thing. And that's something that it never occurred to me. It was told to me by Charlie Adamson, who killed the real Neil McCauley in 1963. And he spoke about McCauley in glowing terms, and would not hesitate for a second to blow him out of his socks, which he eventually did. I asked him, he always wanted to talk to high-line thieves, particularly the really good ones, when he had the opportunity, because they'd arrest the guy, but they didn't really have evidence, but Charlie would use it to spend an hour with the guy and have a completely civil conversation. And his answer was very much like an actor. He said, because I would be picking up things that I didn't even know I was picking up. I could tell by his body language where he kept his hand, how careful he was. He'd be revealing things to me about his life without knowing that he was. I could see how, you know, if he had a weak, if there was a weakness, if there was a vanity.
Yes.
So I would know how he thinks, because I may need to do one or two things. I may need to suddenly make a decision in a critical moment. And I've got to rely on my intuition, and I know that subconsciously I picked up things, and that's going to contribute to my intuitively triggered decision about what I'm going to do. You know, that's why he had coffee with him. And it happened in the Belden Deli on Lincoln Avenue in Chicago.
A nice stand-in for Belden Deli is Kate Manolini's, of course. No longer open. no longer open, are ruining the photo opportunity for all insane Heat fans in perpetuity not to get a photo at that particular table in that diner.
All the good locations in NFL are gone. It's terrible. But the bookstore is gone that Edie worked in. The Broadway deli where he meets Edie, which was terrific, is gone. And the restaurant on Wilshire Boulevard where Macaulay, Kate Madelini's, where Macaulay and Hannah have that coffee shop scene is also gone. And these are favorite restaurants in Los Angeles, and they're all gone for the same reason, because a landlord got greedy and raised the rent. And they were very popular places, and consequently, no restaurant would ever open up there again, because they knew that there was a hostility by everybody in the neighborhood who went to. So the Kate Madelini site has been unoccupied. It's a full restaurant right on Beverly Hills on Wilshire Boulevard, and it has not had a tenant for probably 5 years.
God. Devastating. Moby's God Moving Over the Face of Waters. I was lucky enough to see Heat in a sort of boutique theater in Sydney this year. I saw there a 35mm print of the original, the Warner Brothers theatrical release. And only a few months earlier, right, I saw a gorgeous 4K print. And both of the final scenes, this final minute in particular that we're talking about, the roar of the planes is insanity. It's just, it triggers, goosebumps all over your body. And this score, it just really is, it's a magnificent choice for this song. Can you talk about, you've collaborated with Moby over several films now, but can you talk about this particular moment and needing this and feeling like this particular transcendent score was how it was going to elevate and enhance this scene?
Not really, because it's one of those, it's critically important what that piece of music was. I mean, if you put yourself in my shoes, it'd be, of course, it's critically important what that piece of music is. And that's a state, what state of mind, what feeling does it drop you into?
Yes.
And Moby, it had a power and it almost reminded me of gospel,
Yes.
And, the last thing I am is religious, but nevertheless, it really, many religious things are terribly, terribly moving, and so this was just a powerful piece. And Moby was around quite a bit when we were, in post. We had an insane schedule, and we were editing 24 hours with two different shifts of editors and assistant editors, and I would fall in at strange, times and leave at strange times. I'd come in 3-4 in the morning or something to put in a long day, and I'd find Moby asleep, under the editing machine or something. So he was, it was kind of an open door on a rather large editing facility, because we edited the movie in 16 weeks, which is short. I don't know. I can't really tell you much about it except that, it was, when it drops you into, I can imagine being fresh to it, and as if I'm audience and experiencing it and what I'm feeling. That's a struggle to push yourself, for a director to push himself to that, but you have to. And that was it. Usually for me, I have those key pivotal pieces of music before I'm while I'm shooting or before I'm shooting.
Yes.
But I didn't in this case.
I think Christopher Tapley, who writes for Variety, spoke about a time that he met you. He was on, he's on the show, and he talked about your office at one time just being a wall of CDs, a wall of music, that you could pull from at any given time. You had a very eclectic and thorough library there that you could pull from. So most of the time you're pretty prepared and know what you've got. This one, it was a little bit more organic, you're saying.
Well, the eclecticism of the music choices in Heat was by design. And it's no less designed than, say, the way that, Mohicans is unified by the Celtic music.
Yes.
That's in the, it's from a contemporary Irish folk song called The Gael, G-A-E-L. But the eclecticism was designed because this movie is dropping you into these different lives, and when you're in Krista Herless's life, I want you to be, you know, zoned into that conduit of this kind of postmodern guy who has the exact opposite of Neil. He has no rules, no nothing, you know. But he seems to intuitively, by charm, just kind of, you know, manages to survive everything. He's, by the way, in the novel that you refer to, he's a major character.
I'll hold my excitement and final question around the novel in for just a moment. I'll let you finish that, but I would just say that I think you can unequivocally say that if anyone is listening to this show, and particularly if anyone's been listening to this show since the beginning, you know, we're more than 166 episodes by far, with some bonus episodes and live episodes and whatnot. I think we're almost certain of your intentionality as a filmmaker, and we admire it so deeply and have been scrutinizing it for a couple of years now. So in just this work alone, some magnificent, magnificent choices to change the moods, change it up for each character.
To bring you into that certain track. Now, Elliot Goldenthal's score is brilliant. And if I have one regret, there's a couple of places that I wasn't, that I was like, I should have used some of the cues that he had. I had a choice, and instead I used some other stuff. On the other hand, Lisa Gerrard has five cues that are used.
Yes.
Throughout the movie. And it's just quite, her work is, was a revelation to me. It's 20 some odd years ago now, you know, 24 years ago, but it was really a revelation to hear it. And it took me into that hard to access inner zone of a character, or offer the potential of possibly bring audience into that internal zone of a character. And that's what I try to do. And her music was kind of an agent of that.
So
by the time you get to the end cue, it's got to be everything, you know. It's got to be
yes. That's what I was just about to say. So you've got, you know, all this, the agency, the access, you know, the Lisa Gerrard cues are so phenomenal. I think about the embrace of Vincent and the prostitute's mother, that scene in particular, all the way up to this moment. You know, how that's, and in this moment that we're getting to talk about together, which is why we're sort of having this sprawling chat, is, you know, it's the collective weight that you're mounting on this moment of this epic. You're resting this epic on the shoulders of, you know, these two men, and in some embrace, and then this absolutely glorious, you know, almost, you know, fresco, neon fresco. Designed by yourself and Dante, lit by Dante Spinotti, and designed by yourself, of, you know, the silhouettes against the runway lights on one side and the city lights on the other, in this strange transient space not made for humans. Was that an image that you had in your head as that had to be, you were visualizing to get to this moment, or was that by design at the time when you're in the space?
That was when, you know, I had imagined what that area might look like, and that was the first place I wanted to scout. And we went there and scouted at night, and immediately it came to me that that's the end image, that they'd be in rear shot and silhouette. Macaulay's dead, Hannah's standing there. Here's this fractured moment of time in his life right now, and there are these planes who don't care about you. They don't care about them. These planes are coming in, and the lights are getting brighter, and then they're dimming again, and it's like the lights of the world go off, you know. And so for many reasons, you know, and I confess, I'm thinking about it after the fact, for many reasons, it was very apparent right there. This is the scene. This is the how it's blocked. This qualities has a certain posture, sitting there, not lying down, but sitting there, kind of from a pieta. And I want Hannah looking away into the distance, and as the planes pass them by, bringing people living their lives, who know nothing of what's happened here, into a landing. And there's something else that's a little, that's kind of my own internal language for some of this, and it has to do with time. Hannah exists in a realm of time, and Neil never does. And in the realm of real time, everything is chaotic. Life's a mess.
Yes.
And Hannah's life's a mess. And Macaulay is living by this almost Jesuitical, with a lowercase J, this kind of Jesuitical, rigid doctrine. And he allows into his life only what he allows into his life. So his life is very organized and ordered, as opposed to Hannah's. And here Hannah is, another marriage ended. He's with this guy who's just died, and he's here with the rest of us in the messy, chaotic.
Yes.
And so that's part of it too. And the way airports make us think of time, because we're living and we're entering a world of transience. So all of that is part of that. It's part of that, to me anyway. It's part of that, what that image is about.
So I might ask just one before we wrap up. I have to ask that we now know. Congratulations! You've got your Michael Mann books publications exists. The first one, Hunting LaRue, first book. By Lane Shannon is out, which is a just simply unputdownable, I think, is probably the only thing I can use to describe it. And an upcoming Heat prequel novel. Can you tell people listening about what actually was the tipping point for you to say, no, I want to go back to this universe? Because for us who, and particularly for me, as this obsessive doing this this exercise, I'm so pleased that you would want to go back, and this movie has a certain allure about it. So I'm really interested in about when was the moment that you said, no, I think there's more here, and I think that a novel is a good way to capture that.
What motivated is what preceded the motivation, which is my inability to figure out how to do it. it's such a strong dialectic with two protagonists, and each one antithetical to the other, and so the idea of what couldn't possibly be a sequel, and in the prequel they haven't met each other. But then in working through it at one point, suddenly, it occurred to me, there is a way to do it, and here's how to do it. And I'm not going to say what that is, but there was a way to bring the events of their lives that precede the movie into a conjunction with each other, and a way to carry on what those real passionate concerns were in the years that follow the movie. So the novel goes up to the movie, jumps over the movie, and then continues after the movie.
Well, I'm dying to read it.
And the so that's where we figured that out, and so then it became viable. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it.
I might just say, in wrapping up, because it's an honor to speak to you, but one thing I would just say for everyone listening, this is going to be one of the final episodes of One Heat Minute. So I just wanted to say, firstly, because I'm talking to you, sir, Mr. Michael Mann, thank you so much for being a part of the show now. Thank you so much for this incredible, enduring piece of art. And just to quote you, actually, to quote some of your commentary you once wrote about your top 10, I believe it's cheekily a top 11 films of all time that you wrote for the BFI. You know, some of the words you use to describe your favorite films of all time, I think, are praise that could be heaped upon this masterpiece. You said of Battleship Potemkin that it's a collision of the antithetical, composition of elements. You said of Apocalypse Now that it's a dark identity quest. It's sort of poetic and concrete. You talk about the grand scale of Citizen Kane. You talk about resplendent pathos and poetry in Beautiful. You talk about My Darling Clementine as near perfection cinematically and formally. You talk about in Passion of Joan of Arc, you praise the human experience visualized in the human face. And in Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch, you talk about the poignancy of The Last Of. So I just wanted to say thank you for this symphonic, wonderful thing that I think encapsulates all of the things that you praise your top 10 favorite films of all time about. So thank you so much for being a part of One Heat Minute, and thank you so much.
Well, you're very welcome, and I really have to thank you for, because when you work on something and it becomes alive, the characters become alive, you know what they were doing when they were 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, you know how they got where they are, you know what they're going to do, you hear their voices, you know what they're going to say, and then what is, you know, particularly when they ask, when they deal with those questions about, well, what does my life mean, what am I doing now, they're the universal questions that everybody asks, and if you're fortunate enough to have a story that can bring all these things out, you know, the whole of it becomes alive, and it's a work, it's something that you worked at, and for somebody else to be taken with it to the degree that you've been taken with it is a very, you know, kind of humble gratification that I feel towards this whole show. Yeah, I think what you've done for this film is great. Everybody who makes a film, you know, they want it to sustain in people's consciousness, and for a number of reasons, some of which I know about, some of which I don't know about, you know, Heat apparently has. I have people, you know, who might recognize me in the airport and come up and start quoting lines, and it happens about, you know, once or twice a month. It is surprising that it's endured. You know, it's endured as long. There's a lot of passion that every single person who worked on this film put into it. All the actors, if you'll indulge me for a moment, is that for the actors, working with the actors, it was kind of like an ensemble. And Sean Voight would show up on a day off because he wanted to see what Bob and Al were going to do in a scene that they might have had together. And Krisha Herless wanted to see, you know, a dialogue scene with Bob and Sean Voight as Nate. And that was the feeling about it. We all felt that we were working, and it was great work, and we're all working. I wouldn't say hard, because it was hard work, but it doesn't mean anything. I mean, it just felt like, man, I don't want to be anywhere else on the planet Earth right now at this moment in time than on this set making this movie. You know, that's what.
And to tell you how we receive it, there's no other podcast or project that I would ever dedicate 2 years of my life to in this way than this movie. And talking about this movie with the incredible cachet of guests, you know, some of which, you know, Dante Spinotti, you know, Pasquale Buber, may he rest in peace, was on the show prior to his passing. Wonderful filmmakers, critics, actors. We all are drawn together around this fire of Heat. It's just, it's an incredible piece of art, and And even getting to talk to you, it's a huge honor. But particularly the entire crew that have been part of this show in every iteration of it, have just loved it and loved being a part of it. And I'm personally really proud that when the show ends, it will just exist, and that you know there'll be more Heat fans because it will endure, and they might tangle with us and come and join our little party that'll just sit there forever, as well alongside your work and framing it and talking about it. So yeah, it's excellent.
Great. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, I would say that there's another episode of One Heat Minute just around the corner, but I told you I was never going back.
Yeah.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.